Okay, I was always taught that come to an event, be presentable. Here I am. Can I loosen my tie now? It's a little hot out here. All right, thanks. Appreciate that a lot. All right, so this is going to be an interesting event. I think a lot of you will have a lot of strong opinions about this. I want to remind you, when you're asking your question, please just ask the question. Don't give us a five-minute rant about how angry you are. A lot of people are angry about this situation. The reason we're here is trying to find out how are the ways we can solve it. To help us find those reasons or those ways, I want to introduce you to Ryan Stanton. He's with the Ann Arbor News M Live. Mitch Edelman, with he's the Jackson District Supervisor Remediation and Redevelopment Division of the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality. And Roger Rail, he's soil residents for Safe Water. We did ask the current owners of the old Gelman Science Center to be here tonight. They declined our invitation, so we just want to make sure you understand we're trying to be as fair as possible. These guys were foolish enough to show up, so here we go. Let's start with the beginning. Ryan, you've done a lot of good reporting, really solid reporting on that. You've actually been on our show at Stateside to talk about some of your reporting. Can you give us just a little bit of a chronological idea of what happened when and how this stuff got into the groundwater?
Yeah, so I'll try to give a quick history lesson for those who don't know. I'm sure a lot of you do know this history, but there was a company called Gelman Sciences out on Wagner Road, right on the border of Sow Township in Ann Arbor, so the west side of the city there, just north of Liberty Road. They, between the 60s and the 80s, they dumped a whole bunch of chemical pollutants into the environment, dioxane. It is a chemical that causes cancer, or it's a probable human carcinogen, they call it, and it's by all routes of exposure. They were discharging it behind their property. It got into, you know, a nearby lake and streams and just spread, and it is now, all these years later, we discovered the plume in the 80s. We're still trying to address it. It still continues to spread further into Sow Township, further into Ann Arbor, and it's about 4 miles wide, or a mile wide and 4 miles long at this point by some estimates.
Mitch, I want to ask you, how or why was Gelman Sciences allowed to pollute the groundwater as has happened? What were the regulations then? How do we get this legacy pollution now?
So back when they first started in using 1,4-dioxane in the manufacturing process.
And tell us what that is.
It's 1,4-dioxane, right? Is a solvent that was used in the manufacture, in this case, of medical filters. 1,4-dioxane is also used, and you'll see it as a contaminant at other hazardous waste sites, as a solvent stabilizer. Yet, in the case of Gelman, it was used in its pure form to, I believe, clean the medical filters that Gelman was manufacturing. So, to your question, Lester, about why it was allowed to use it, back, our environmental laws have evolved over the past number of years. And so, when they first started discharging in 1966, it was under a permit from an entity that was called the Water Resources Commission, and there was no other treatment alternative. So various, as Ryan said, various ways of managing it that included spray irrigation, disposal in lagoons, direct discharge to surface waters, all was allowed, some of which was permitted, some of which was not permitted, and that becomes an important factor in the overall legal framework and the remediation of the site.
Because there's more presumed responsibility in that case.
Liability is more liability associated with unpermitted discharges than otherwise. Right.
So, Roger, you've been monitoring this for 23 years. Tell us when we first found out that this dioxane, this 1,4-dioxane, was actually polluting drinking wells and moving.
Well, it was actually discovered by a single U of M graduate student, Dan Bicknell. He was a master's student in the School of Public Health, and he noticed some runoff from the Gelman Sciences site and tested it. And it showed a spike in a mass spectrometer analysis, so he looked it up and he says, well, that's dioxane. Dioxane doesn't occur in nature. But it took him a year and a half to convince the authorities that this was a big issue. So that was
which authorities are we talking about? We're talking about the existing regulatory agency at the time, or
well, it was the first with the county, and then the state, and then of course the company had to pony up that. Yeah, well, we actually used 850,000 pounds of this over the last 20 years. You know, they were required to tell the state what was in their effluent during all those years. They never said it was dioxane. They called it ethylene glycol ethers. There were other things that were nasty, too, but nothing as highly mobile and persistent as dioxane. That's what sets dioxane apart from a lot of the other contaminants. So this is really a long-term issue, and we have to look at it for centuries, decades.
And that gets us to the point. This has been around for a couple of decades or longer. Why are we, again, talking about it right now? Ryan, you've been reporting on that. What's happened lately that has put this back in the news suddenly?
Yeah, so obviously there was a big, huge water crisis just to the north of us in Flint that got a lot of media attention, and that kind of put water on the minds of a whole lot of people. So around January, concerns were just really heightened about the issue of safe, clean water in communities and how we ensure that, how we protect that, and you know how we safeguard against threats to it. And Ann Arbor's been dealing with this for decades, and it's not a new issue. It's been around for, well, we've known about it for over 30 years now. So this is, all kind of come to a head since the Flint water crisis. And at the same time, it's kind of a confluence of factors because at the DEQ has been working for the last few years to revise the state standard for dioxane to set a stricter limit in keeping with federal science. The EPA told us back in 2010 that dioxane in drinking water at 3.5 parts per billion poses a 1 in 100,000 cancer risk. Our 85 part per billion state standard, so a whole lot higher than that, was supposed to give us a 1 in 100,000 cancer risk, and we're learning that that was a little off, a little outdated, not protective of public health. So the city and the county and a lot of citizen activists like Roger over here have been fighting for, you know, 3 or 4 years now to really get the DEQ to follow through on revising that state standard, and it's all kind of coming to a head now, and that a new standard of 7.2 was finally proposed in April, and now we're kind of going through that rules promulgation process. The DEQ is talking about going back to court with the polluter to apply that to the Gelman site.
So we're going to talk about these numbers a little bit, and I know it's a little boring numbers, but I'm going to make it really clear. There was a standard under the Engler administration. That standard was loosened a lot, and now they've been working on for about 6 years trying to get an appropriate standard. I want to ask you to explain a little bit of that, why it takes so long to go through this process. But before I do any of that, why do we have a standard that's different from the EPA's? Why don't we just use the U.S. EPA standard?
Well, the short answer is EPA does not have a standard. And maybe it's important to define what we mean by standard. And I'll define what I mean when I say EPA doesn't have a standard. EPA doesn't have a legally enforceable number for 1,4 dioxane. Michigan currently does have one that's promulgated under rule, and that's 85 parts per billion. And as Ryan said, I totally agree. We're in the midst of a process to change that. We've proposed a number of 7.2, and if and when that becomes promulgated, that becomes a legally enforceable number.
Okay, so what was the I'm going to do this in chronological level. What was the level for Michigan standard before the Engler administration changed it?
That's THREE, 3 parts per billion.
3 parts per billion. And then the Engler administration and the agency at the time then decided, look, you know, there's only so much benefit from going that far. Let's just, what would it mean if only one person in 100,000, which, you know, this town being a town of about 100,000, one of you getting cancer is not that big of a deal. So let's raise it to 85 parts per billion. How did they justify that at the time?
Well, I think it's important, Lester, to back up a step from that. So I first started my career with the Department of Natural Resources in 1985. We had a discussion back then that, remember, this followed Superfund, the Federal Hazardous Waste Cleanup Act, was passed in 1980 in the wake of Love Canal. And then Michigan followed suit in 1982 with something called the Michigan Environmental Response Act. And we didn't have any cleanup standards, nor did the feds. So after we started listing sites for prioritization and cleanup, we started confronting the question pretty early on in 1985 and thereafter, how clean should clean be? How clean is clean or how dirty is clean, depending on your one's perspective. In fact, I've got a haiku. I'd like to do haikus to offer some synopsis of thoughts. So I'm going to give you a haiku about the whole risk-based thing, and then I'll answer your question.
Let's hear it.
How clean should clean be? Risk-based decision-making, clean may be dirty. So my point there is that it's a relative thing. In 1990, Senator Lana Pollock, as many of you know, was instrumental in getting the polluter pay law established. Actually, it was prior to the establishment of that law that we had our first set of rules, and those rules dictating cleanup, and those were now growth of the litigation that the state initiated against Gelman. Charles Gelman said 307 required you to have rules, so the court sided with them. We developed rules. We used a 1 in a million excess cancer risk target back in 1990, and that's how the 3 parts per billion got established. And that was based on a number of assumptions on the toxicity of the chemical at the time, based on how much water people were going to drink and for how long. And so that was 1990, 1991. 1995, there were amendments to the law that Senator Pollock passed or was instrumental in passing, and that changed the risk level from the 1 in a million to 1 in 100,000 for cancer causing.
What was the justification?
The legislature and governor justified it by saying that 1 in a million was too strict. It was too much conservatism was built into those assumptions, and that it was an impediment to manufacturing and jobs in Michigan. It's the classic jobs versus the environment argument.
Okay, so we've gone through that. Now, tell me, why has it taken so long for the DEQ to go through this process to come to this new 7.2 parts per billion.
So as Ryan said, in 2010, EPA formally revised their toxicological profile for the chemical concern 1,4-dioxane. And another decision that was made in part of the 1995 process and the subsequent rule revision was that the numbers that become enforceable under law that got promulgated were going to be promulgated, the numbers were going to be promulgated as opposed to the equations that generated those numbers. So in 2010, when EPA changed the toxicological...
Okay, back up. Explain that to me. Okay. Why?
So why did that happen?
Yeah. And I don't want to get too deep in the weeds here, but it just seems like I understand that it's very difficult to come up with regulatory rules that keep the public safe, and yet don't cost as much money as the whole state budget. But it just seems like it's so Byzantine when everybody wants it to be very, very simple. Let's keep the water safe. Let's make the polluters pay. Let's make sure this standard doesn't put anybody at risk if we can.
So that happened because the legislature said so and the governor signed it.
Okay. All right. Roger, you're over there. I can just tell you just want to talk about this.
Yeah. Mitch gets a lot of time on here, so I'll try to make mine short.
Mitch has got complicated stuff to explain. Seriously. You know, I don't envy his job at all.
I told Mitch before, anything I say today is nothing personal, but the DEQ's culture has changed over the last 20 years.
In what way?
Well, first of all, it didn't used to be the DEQ.
Right.
It was part of the DNR. And what Engler comes in, and he pulls the DNR out of the DEQ, so there's no more citizen oversight.
Right.
In fact, when we won a point in the contested case, instead of going to the Natural Resources Commission to keep the discharge levels low, it didn't go to the Natural Resources Commission anymore. It went to the director of the DEQ. And what does the director of the DEQ do? Instead of rubber stamping it, he says, well, I think we should loosen those. I think we should have more discharge levels. So that's the kind of thing that we're living with ever since. Now, in terms of how it got from 3 to 77 to 85, it used to be 3 parts per billion, 1 in a million cancer risk over a 70-year lifetime exposure. the legislature in England said, well, you know, we have all these urban brownfields. And there was an urban brownfield report that was co-authored by one of Gelman's lawyers. And that urban brownfield report became the basis for the law change to loosen the standards to 1 in 100,000 over a 30-year lifetime exposure. But instead of it just applying it to urban areas, urban brownfields, they applied it statewide. So at the time we said, well, this will allow slacker companies to turn green fields into tan fields or brown fields. And that's what we've been living with ever since. That's why we have a plume that's expanding and it's allowed to expand because of the weak laws. And why do we have weak laws? Because we have weak legislators. So it comes down to people voting. And one of our sayings at SIO Resmer Safe Water is, you know, we're about two-thirds water. All of us are just walking bags of water. We should act accordingly.
Okay, so let's clear up one more thing, and then we're going to open it to questions. Tell me, how close is the water or the dioxane getting to Ann Arbor's water supply, and how many wells have been polluted or shut down because of risk of contamination? Well, let me start with Ryan, because he's reported on this quite a bit. In fact, you talked to a family who actually experienced their well being polluted, and they weren't even aware. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, so to the first part of your question, yeah, even going back to the late 80s, you know, it was known then that immediately after the discovery of the plume, or not too long after, that dozens and dozens of wells were polluted, and that needed to be remediated. People got hooked up to city water, annexed into the city, and yeah, just it was a lot of wells. And today, there's a handful of wells on, you know, west of Ann Arbor in the, you know, fringe of Ann Arbor, Scioto Township, where, yeah, some wells are polluted with dioxane. There was a family on Jackson Road that we wrote about in March that they were renting the house, so they didn't know a whole lot. They'd moved up here from Alabama. They didn't know the history. And they were living in a house where it was still on well water. Known dioxane was in that well being tested regularly for over a decade.
With kids.
They had three young kids they were raising, 1, 2, and 3. And, they had, you know, if you go back a decade before they were there, the dioxane readings were about 54 parts per billion. And while they were there, it hovered between, like, 17 and 30. And, they were drinking that, using that, cooking in it, bathing in it, mixing infant formula with it. And when they found out in March Dan Bicknell reached out to them first. Dan and I both had the idea to kind of reach out to those people as soon as we saw the numbers coming in, and as this kind of issue came to a, you know, the issue heightened, in, as we said earlier. We went out there, talked to them. They immediately scrambled and got out of there. We learned that Paul Corporation was responsible for testing their water and providing them regular reports, and because it was below 85 parts per billion, but still not safe based on what we know of the federal guidelines, they were told your water is safe to drink, keep drinking. That's what...
So is it a little inconsistent then, Ryan, to say that on the one hand they didn't know about it, but then on the other hand admit that they were getting results from the company?
But if they don't know what they are, if they don't know what they mean...
They didn't know the water was unsafe. They had an idea that there was an issue. They knew that there were tests being done, and...
I mean, how many of us actually know what 1,4-dioxane
before? We had been talking to the county health department and others throughout the evolution of this remediation, and there was never any public health determination of the water being unsafe. Had there been such a determination, we would have acted accordingly. So I think in the interests of fully informing your readers and the listeners here, we need to make sure it's clear that there was never a determination that those people were drinking unsafe levels. Now, it's true that we proposed a number. Yes. When we proposed 7.2, if we promulgate it, then we're going to have to act accordingly. In effect, we worked with the company to get the water hooked up to municipal water.
This is going to sound really unfair to you because you didn't have anything to do with it, but this sounds much like what we heard out of Flint. There's nothing wrong. The water's safe. Don't worry about it. We had no responsibility to tell the people. Now, I'm not trying to be unfair to you. You had nothing to do with Flint. You weren't involved in that. But why should we believe the MDEQ? Why should the MDEQ be telling these people instead of relying on the corporation to tell them and making sure that they understand these levels mean this kind of risk for your family. This is what this chemical is. I mean, who was doing that? You're expecting the corporation to do that?
Well, I think that's a good point, Lester, and we've learned from that, and we've been working with County Health and ensuring that the additional wells that we sample going forward, we're handing out fact sheets that we all agree on that adequately represent the potential risks associated
with it. And that's being done now?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
So I think it's safe to say if I had to do it over again, I would have made sure that somebody with a public health background was handing out fact sheets and or having conversations with that family and others that were drinking it. Now, and keep in mind that at that time, we didn't even know what the proposed number was going to be. So once we found out what that number...
But you had 6 years. You probably had some kind of idea, right? I mean, 6 years of process.
You knew it was going to be single digits.
And this was likely to be single digits.
This is within a six-year period. You knew it was going to be single digits. The letter still said 85 is safe. So these people didn't know that you're going to be going to single digits.
And I'll point out that
when it became a news item, you're out there the next day because Flint water crisis. It's really tragic that it took a Flint water crisis to focus people's attention back on how important water is.
Okay. You all know Kristen. Kristen has the microphone. I want to keep, tell us who you're directing your question to. Please have a question in there. And if you want all three of them to respond, that's fine too. Tell us your name. She'll hold the mic.
Okay, Vince Caruso, Ann Arbor. Thanks for having this program today. I appreciate it. So the city council and the county board of commissioners are debating, mostly the county board of commissioners right now, debating whether this should be an EPA Superfund site.
Right, there's been a petition put together.
Well, the commission has actually discussed it last night at a board meeting, and they postponed it, unfortunately, in my opinion. I would like to hear the panel's discussion of, and I guess the main issue is EPA a bad deal or is EPA a good deal? Is this the Ghostbusters or is this going to be something better? I think it'll be better. That's my opinion and opinion of a lot of people I've talked to are knowledgeable. So I'd like to get their opinion on that. That's a critical issue right now.
I'm not an expert, but I did cover the environment for 12 years. And I dealt quite a bit with the Superfund. And, you know, usually in a Superfund situation, all the money that's spent by the federal government, or not all of it, but a good portion of it is spent on lawyers, and the results are not always that great. So let's talk about EPA intervention versus EPA Superfund. Roger, let's start with you this time. What do you think of that idea?
Well, you know, back in the day when I first got involved in this, I said, well, you know, we don't need to have a Superfund site because we have a state agency that can maybe take care of this. But over the last two decades, I've come to a different opinion because the culture of the DQ is set by the legislature and set by people with a higher pay grade than Mitch. Doesn't matter what Mitch thinks. It matters what the directors and the associate directors and the department heads think. So we're not going to change the DEQ's culture anytime soon. Now, the EPA can come in. It's not going to be like the old Superfunds where, you know, you've got a crisis and we've got to clean it up and move everybody out. No, what we're trying to do here with enough EPA support is to prevent a future Flint water crisis. It may not happen next year or two decades from now, but we got to prevent this plume from spreading in our grandchildren's or great-grandchildren's lifetimes. And the DEQ is not thinking that long-term. They can think 30 years out, and that's about it.
Got it. So Mitch, would you address this question, please?
And I've got a perspective. I'm not going to offer an opinion on Superfund, but I've got a perspective that I want to share with you and let you know that perspective includes prior to the 15 years I've spent in the Jackson District for the DEQ, I worked 16 years for the DNR and DEQ in the Superfund program. So I know a lot about how remedies are selected in the Superfund process. And want to share with you that there's no certainty in an outcome if this were to become a Superfund site. EPA, their remedy selection criteria include overall protection of public health and the environment and compliance with applicable or relevant appropriate requirements, which means relevant state and federal laws. Our Michigan law falls smack dab in the middle of the range that EPA uses to make decisions. EPA at, and I would encourage people to look at the staff report that Washtenaw County Public Health put together for the Board of Commissioners looking at the resolution that Vince mentioned, because it's obvious that EPA has employed institutional controls at a number of Superfund sites in Michigan. One thing they failed to mention when they talked about the monitored natural attenuation so-called remedy that's available under Superfund is that that monitored natural attenuation includes not only biodegradation, but dilution and dispersion of groundwater. So the answer is it's not simple. I don't have a good crystal ball. I don't think anybody can predict with a great degree of certainty what the outcome is. Yet I would expect, since EPA has accepted Michigan's remediation statute and the criteria that emerge from it to be relevant, enforceable criteria under the federal law as well as the state law, that they would, presuming our 7.2 gets promulgated, use that number as a cleanup target for the site.
I'm going to take that as trust the devil you know rather than the devil you don't.
Well, you can take it that I just need to make sure I respond to Roger's comment. The DEQ does care about people drinking safe water and assuring that they have it. Ann Arbor gets 80% of their drinking water from the Huron River, roughly 20% from drinking water wells. We, when we modified the consent judgment in March of 2011, we assured additional monitoring was in place with targets at roughly a quarter of the current 85 parts per billion number. And presuming we get a legally enforceable number of 7.2, we're going to work with the company to get additional monitoring and contingencies in place to make sure the people are drinking safe water.
Ryan, I want to give you an opportunity to respond to his question if he had...
Yeah, there's a lot of mixed opinions out there about how EPA's Superfund would play out versus the current approach. Some people think it could only get better, and you know, there's some people who say the EPA has, you know, it has administrative authority to issue orders, to order cleanup, more powers than the DEQ has. There's still questions about, we have a current consent judgment that was hashed out in our local court, whether the EPA could override that or not. That was debated last night as the county board discussed this. The county's attorney thought so, but it was unsure. They needed to look into it more. So there's still some unanswered questions. Some people see it as a roll of the dice. There's no certainty. There's conflicting information with how EPA Superfund is played out with other sites in Michigan. But like I said, there's mixed opinions. There's some people who are a lot more confident in it and some people who still want more information. And I think you'll see the county board make a decision next month on this.
All right, let's take another question.
Hi, this is Elliot Mark. I moved to Ann Arbor on Monday. I was wondering how, this is sort of answering the last question, but how would a cleanup work?
Yeah, I mean, seriously, we've got a chemical that's underground that's mixing with the contaminated soil, mixing with the water. I'm going to give Roger a shot at this first. How do you clean up something like this?
Well, the best solution is pump and treat. And the best treatment is UV oxidation. Now, the company's not using UV oxidation.
Okay, you're using some terminology that not all of us are familiar
with. UV oxidation turns out to be ultraviolet light and hydrogen peroxide, and it helps break down the very strong dioxin compound.
Pump and treat means you drill a well, you pump out the contaminated
water.
You
treat it, and you dispose of it. Now, UV oxidation can treat it all the way down to non-detect. If you completely mineralize dioxin, you get carbon dioxide in water. You know what carbon dioxide in water is? Sparkling water. It's Perrier. I once told a Paul vice president, you guys are a high-tech filtration company. You should show what you can do with your technology. Instead of spending money on lawyers, spend it on technology and marketing and sell this for 50 cents a bottle and make $1 billion. Of course, they didn't do that.
You're a real optimist, aren't you?
Well, no, I mean, they could do this. I mean, water is going to be the key thing in coming decades, you know, as more and more glaciers meld and more water sources dry up and get polluted.
I can see the label now. Was 1.4 dioxide, new and improved carbonated water.
Well, but with marketing, you can do a lot. And technology, you can do a lot. But let me tell you the other thing about this. They used to use UV oxidation, but then several years ago, they said, well, there's this cheaper technology that we can use that'll save us half our cost. Can we use that? And because the discharge limits were like 7 parts per billion into the tributary, this other treatment technology cannot treat to non-detect, but it can treat less than the discharge limit. It's called ozone oxidation. Now, the problem with ozone oxidation here is we have naturally occurring bromide in our water. And what happens when you have ozone treatment? It creates a new carcinogen. A new carcinogen gets created in this process and gets disposed of along with the partially treated dioxin. Bromate is the new carcinogen. And that's going into the tributary, going into Honey Creek, and going into the Huron River. Now, it's at a level that is non-detect by the time it gets in, but the DEQ allowed them to save money and create a new carcinogen. I don't think the EPA would have done that.
Okay, so did the DEQ have the opportunity to say no to that, since it did get the discharge at the level or below the level that was required? I mean, let Mitch ask.
It was permitted.
So the DEQ did permit the change from ultraviolet oxidation to ozone and hydrogen peroxide. The reason we did it is because both of those are oxidation technologies. The discharge limits are permissible under federal Clean Water Act, under which our state discharge limits derive. And things associated with the water that Paul was treating has high levels of iron. So in order to undergo this ultraviolet treatment, they had to pre-treat it with sulfuric acid, sodium hydroxide, sodium bisulfate, and hydrogen peroxide. So as a result of the change from ultraviolet to ozone, we now have, on average, 136,000 less pounds per month of sulfuric acid and 279,000 less pounds per month of sodium hydroxide being used in the treatment process.
Is it the judgment of the DEQ that this is a safer process than?
It's as safe. It's a permissible process. It reduces the concentrations of 1,4 dioxin. And the gentleman asked a question about cleanup. So this, it's an important point to talk about cleanup, and that gets to the haiku I talked about earlier. How clean should clean be? Some people, and this goes back to an earlier question you asked too, Lester, how did we arrive at risk-based decision-making? Well, as our analytical capabilities get better over time, we can detect lower and lower concentrations. And for molecules like 1,4-dioxane or trichloroethylene or other contaminants that we deal with, the more you can see, the more that begs the question, how much, if any, of that is safe? That's how we ended up. That's how the legislature ended up with risk-based decision-making. And so how do you clean it up? In part depends on what endpoint you want to achieve, and in part depends on what's an acceptable risk to individuals.
I want to ask both you guys, and Ryan, jump in here if you have some insight to this. Is this the only way we can clean this up? Is it just pump and treat? Is there any other way to can we deep well inject it?
Well, yeah.
Can we?
Yeah.
Well, you deep well inject the effluent. That's a possibility, and they've done that several times. They've claimed that it's too expensive, so they don't do that anymore.
So it's cancer.
Another technology that has been proven at other sites that are at smaller scale is something called in situ injection to oxidize the contaminated groundwater in place. Gelman has done some pilot tests on that. I think it was probably about 6-8 years ago, using, again, injecting with DEQ approval ozone, hydrogen peroxide into the groundwater to cause that to oxidize in place.
But that's not going to work at 100 to 300 feet deep. That might work in shallow areas. The marshy area that still has really high concentrations.
It was proven not to be feasible in part for some of the reasons Roger mentioned. So at a scale that we're talking about here, given the large scale, in situ oxidation probably isn't the best. So you're left with pump and treat, which historically we've had to answer questions about what do we do with the water once it's treated. And Roger lives on the banks of Honey Creek. There's concerns about too much water going in there causing additional erosion. We had one in 2004 when the DEQ issued a decision document on the deeper contamination wherein we said the company had to extract much more contaminated groundwater than they were doing at the time. We heard from some citizens in the city of Ann Arbor that they were not in favor of installing additional wells and pipes. So the issue of where do you dispose of the treated water really becomes a complicating factor associated with it.
I'll just add to this. That was a good discussion of the techniques and methods in pumping and treating. In addition to those techniques, there's just a general belief among a lot of people that a lot more pumping and treating in terms of quantity can be done. The current permit that Gelman has says you can pump and treat and discharge up to 1,300 gallons a minute. And I think they used to be doing a lot more than they were now. And last I looked, they're closer to 500 gallons a minute. So there's a belief among a lot of people that we could be holding them to a higher standard, doing more, picking up the pace. And we're talking about a multi-billion-dollar corporation that has the means.
Kristen, where are you? There you are. Next question.
Hi, my name is Reed Hamilton, and I live in Scio Township off Honey Creek. I'm curious what's known, if anything, about the effect of this spill on fish and wildlife in the Huron River Basin.
Has there been any testing on that?
No testing has been done that I'm aware of. We do have criteria that are protective of the aquatic organisms, and if you've done any homework on this, hang on.
How do you know if they're protected if you haven't tested it?
I said are protective. As you know from the work you've done, Lester, in terms of the Safe Drinking Water Act, we use risk-based decision-making to determine what levels of chemicals are safe in wastewater that gets discharged from manufacturing processes.
Can you eat the fish? Is it safe to eat the fish?
Yeah. Because the concentration that is allowable under permit for discharges downstream of a drinking water intake are 2,800 parts per billion. We haven't seen anything near that in the surface waters over time.
And it doesn't bioaccumulate. It turns out that if you really want to dispose of it...
If you're going to talk about bioaccumulate, you've got to explain it. So bioaccumulate, little fish gets poisoned, a bigger fish eats a lot of these little fish, medium-sized fish is eaten by the bigger fish, so he eats a lot of those, and each time that chemical gets larger and larger concentrations as the animals get bigger or older.
But also, it's not like lead. It's not like heavy metals that accumulate and stay in your body and cause brain changes.
Or PCBs or mercury or dioxin, something like that.
This stuff, your body can break down 85% of it, and then 15% goes out in your pee. But what happens to those molecules when they break down? You know, what is it destroying the ends of your telomeres at the end of your chromosomes?
The question was about fish and aquatic organisms, right?
Well, but the same thing's true for fish and other things. You know, they don't live long enough maybe to be affected by this. You know, maybe turtles, they live quite a long time. But, you know, let's not have a lot of it in the surface water from the discharge. And fortunately, we don't. We've managed. The company wanted to dump 60 or 100 parts per billion into the surface water, and the DEQ was fine with that. We took them to court in a contested case, and that's the point we won in the contested case. The SIO residents and then the city and the county joined that contested case. That's why, you know, the fish and the birds are thanking us. But we have to take care of what our water, the threat to our water supplies in the future. And even long before it gets to Barton Pond, it's going to affect dozens and hundreds of township wells. We can't let that happen.
And we agree with that, Roger. We don't want to see that happen. We've got a monitoring plan in place based on the current criteria. We're going to renegotiate a more robust monitoring plan based on a new lower number. We're working with the county health department to monitor wells that we think are in proximity to the plume as we know it, and we're going to continue to assure that people have safe drinking water.
And this is a graph of the state sampling over the last 20 years. Which way is the number of samples going, up or down? This is as of 2012.
Mitch, is that residential well samples?
These are the state sampling.
State residential well samples.
Right. Around the peripheral of the plume.
Mitch, is this correct?
I've got to look at it.
Now, had it not been for the Flint water crisis, it would still be on this curve.
But the Flint water crisis brought this back to the surface. We are working closely in collaboration with the county health department to sample wells that are at risk, and we'll sample wells that we think are necessary and assure that the company does so.
And this graph is a graph of the planned samples by the company over the coming 3 decades. And at the end of that, they're going to run out of money. And how much dioxin is going to be left? So we don't know.
What do you mean
no
they're going to run out? Are you talking about the financial assurance mechanism?
This is from the financial assurance mechanism.
You're misrepresenting that letter of credit, Roger.
This is the Excel spreadsheet that was supporting that letter of credit.
And that's going to get updated every 5 years. So
okay, I think I know what your next story should be.
it's not accurate to say that they're going to run out of money.
All right,
another thing, we were successful when we amended the...
Are the number of samples going down?
We got a letter of credit, a financial assurance mechanism that wasn't previously in place that's available for the state to take over and make sure that people have safe drinking water and that the remediation continues.
Let's take another question.
Hi, my name is Johanna. I'm a mom of 3 living here on the Old West Side. My oldest son is a 15-year-old leukemia survivor and endured 5 years of rigorous chemo. My middle child is a typical middle child, not so typical, but... And my youngest daughter was born with a rare genetic disorder resulting in cerebral palsy, autism, and various things. So my parenting journey is all about risk-based decision-making. So when I hear human carcinogen... For me, the statistics are 0 or 100%.
Right.
My son is at risk of relapsing or getting secondary cancers as a risk to environmental exposures. Dioxin is an environmental exposure. I live over the plume. How are you going to ensure that I have the information necessary to make the risk-based decisions that I need to make as a parent protecting the life of my child who has had a pre-existing cancer?
Mitch?
Yeah. I'm glad to hear your son is doing better.
I have one more thing, too, just to clarify, in that we've been talking about water, but water also connects with soil and air when it evaporates and my basement when it floods.
Okay, so the question was, what are we going to do to assure that you've got the information necessary to make decisions for you to protect your family, right? So we're working with the state and the county public health people to get the facts out related to both drinking water and that ladder pathway that you mentioned.
So you've mentioned this several times. And how many of you live in this area affected by the plume? How many of you got information from MDEQ or the county health department? So when is this information going to be released? You're working with them, they're going to notify people.
The fact sheet that's already been handed out has only been handed out to people whose wells have been sampled, and that's primarily been in Scioto Township because the people living over the plume, are you on municipal water or do you have your own well?
We where we are interfacing with wells and we have no idea what exposure we are allowing to occur to ourselves, our loved ones, and our community. Businesses are not able to inform their consumers. We're not offering tap water for our service today because we're at risk of dioxin. We have all bottled water, whatever it may be. We don't just exist in our little silos of our homes over our wells. This is Ann Arbor. I mean, it has to be talked about as if we're moving living people.
So what did you mean when you said you're talking about the water here tonight? You're concerned is whether it's safe? Yes, this is city water here. And the city does a great job of providing safe water to people. They voluntarily stopped using. Remember I said earlier that the city gets 80% of their water from the river, 20% from wells. One of the wells did show very low levels of the 1,4-dioxane. The city voluntarily stopped using it. So I trust the city is doing a good job of making sure that their citizens are drinking safe water.
Right.
In terms of your question about what are we going to do and what have we been doing, so most recently we've worked with the county and state health department to provide information to those homes and businesses whose wells have been sampled to talk about why we're sampling them, what we're going to do if certain concentrations are exceeded. What we're in the process of doing, to answer Lester's question, is providing developing additional fact sheets to talk about the concern the questioner asked relative to what happens when water is in someone's basement that may have dioxane in it and it evaporates. Now, so I don't have a time frame. I hope to have that fact sheet out within the next month. Now, another thing that...
Let me ask you guys a quick question.
I got to jump. You got to talk risk communication. 1,4-dioxane, I don't know how many people know that 1,4-dioxane is available, is present in many consumer products. Raise your hand if you knew that.
Yeah.
Ty, at what levels, Vince? In parts per million, that's 2,000 parts per billion.
But we're not drinking it,
right?
Right. But let me ask an important question here.
If you have concerns like she does, if you have concerns that you're in contact with hers, is there a test kit that you can obtain to check it for yourself, or are we completely reliant on government testing it for us, or the Gelman Sciences owners testing it for us?
Okay, so. There's testing for water that's available, and that's the information on that is available. You can get a hold of me at Edelmanm@mi.gov or
Can the health department help us get there?
Washtenaw County Health can certainly help. They've got a list of labs in the area that can sample for water. The question, my phone number, or Washtenaw County Public Health, We can put that. Can we put that on the website when this program airs? Or,
Or there's a newspaper in town who could do something about that. I don't know.
Wait, say that again.
There's a newspaper in town who might be able.
Oh,
to
okay. Yeah.
Put that out.
All right. And in terms of the other sampling for potential vapors, we've done some research to see what kind of labs have and what their detection limits are for this stuff, and. It's when we have done vapor sampling for other contaminants, like I mentioned earlier, the dry cleaner solvent, PERC, which is short for perchloroethylene. Up here, or just south of here, we've got a dry cleaner that's got an apartment building adjacent to it that has had vapors from that dry cleaning solvent emanating from the subsurface, contaminated groundwater and soils. So we do vapor sampling. We had EPA in here a number of years ago to sample for that with a big bus that they've got, a lab in place.
Yeah, I guess the question has been answered already. We want to know if there's a test kit or somebody who can test it for us, even if it's a small fee. Roger, you're getting squirmy over there. You have something to say?
Yeah, well, you know, again, right now the city water is safe. And I would bet that most wells are safe. And you can have the testing done by different outfits. Sia Residents for Safe Water has links. The county has links. The city has links. It's not free.
It's not free. No.
And that's one of the issues that we think the EPA would make a difference on, that they would have the responsible party test the peripheral, test the wells around the edge of the plume, instead of taxpayers having to pay for it. I don't know how many of you know this, but the DEQ settled with the company a couple years ago without consulting any of the card members for $500,000 for all past and future costs for monitoring. This was within the six-year period that they knew was going to go down to single-digit parts per billion. And then a couple years later, they had to go back and ask for $700,000 out of the Clean Michigan Initiative to pay for future monitoring. The Clean Michigan Initiative is a bond that's paid for by taxpayers. You know, this is not the direction we need to go.
So if we want to talk about the settlement, it's important to put that in context, that the choice the state had to make was, in the wake of now-retired Judge Shelton, right before he retired, some of the money that we had asserted the company was on the hook for in the form of fines and penalties, $5 million of which, along with a couple hundred thousand that the state had incurred already in the course of our sampling residential wells, or providing money to the county to sample residential wells to assure people are safe, we were confronted with the real possibility that the company was going to get the judge to dismiss those $5 million in fines and penalties, and we were going to therefore lose our ability to get that $200,000. So put the settlement of $500,000 in the context of $5 million versus nothing. It's a tough choice. I don't like making that choice, but I mentioned my Superfund experience.
Wait a minute. Did you make that choice?
I did not make that choice
then
myself.
You didn't.
Okay.
I did support the choice given all things considered. Other Superfund sites I worked on, we had a site in Muskegon that went to the Supreme Court.
Okay, I want to hear from Ryan, because he covered some of this, and I'm wondering, you know, what did you learn when you look back at the history in this $500,000 settlement and some of the other things that we've seen happen? Give us a little history of what they're talking about here.
Yeah, no, I think they covered it well. The $500,000 settlement did, kind of give away some of our ability to recoup some costs going forward, and I'll leave it up to Mitch to articulate what that did and didn't entail, because I don't have all the details up here right now. But, basically...
You were supposed to bring your notes tonight. You did not bring your notes.
Sorry, man, I let you down. This consent judgment that they're talking about, kind of the really important thing that we should be talking about right now is that there's a window of opportunity here now that the standard is being revised to 7.2 parts per billion. There's a window of opportunity to go back to court, and the DEQ is planning to do that, I believe, and, you know, assert that, we need to apply the 7.2 standard, and that kind of opens up the door to say, let's talk about some other parts of the consent judgment, and can we get a better cleanup? Can we get more monitoring? Can we do more investigations? Can we get the company to pay more? And so that's kind of the real, that's in front of us right now. That's a real possibility. And the question is, how hard is the DEQ going to push, and will the city and county join in that legal fight and assert standing and be parties?
We're going to take another question. We've been going on this for a while.
It's going to depend on the AG, though.
Yeah, I have a question.
What's your name?
Name is Tom Nalepa. I live on the west side of Ann Arbor in Silo Township. And my question is, I've seen a lot of graphs like that one, figures on the vertical spread of the plume, but I haven't seen much at all on the vertical extent of the plume. And the reason I ask is that those of us in Silo Township have wells of various depths. And those, obviously, the shallow depths are much more risk than the deeper depths. But so my question is, how deep is the maximum extent has dioxin been found, and how deep do these monitoring wells go?
All right, this is my bailiwick, because what I do and what I've done on this...
Hold it a little closer. That'll make it better.
Is it me that's getting the feedback? Okay. So what I've been doing on this for 23 years is trying to get all the facts and put it together in displays like this that you won't see anywhere else. The judge never saw any display like this. We do have displays that show the depth, and it goes from the surface all the way down to bedrock, 300 feet in some cases. So there are wells that are shallow that sometimes are okay, and the deep well is not. There's some places where the shallow wells are contaminated and the deep ones are not. There's some places that it's 100, 200 feet of contamination through the whole aquifer. So if you go to srsw.org, you can get a Google Earth mashup and do your own displays and see what's going on.
Can't hear you, Tom.
Yeah, talk to me afterward. One of the things that I've been doing is taking all of the information I can from the DEQ. This is a graph of the number of documents on the DEQ website. They used to have a very complete list of documents, and they used to have like a monthly summary, right, Dan?
You're talking about documents about the dioxane.
Well, not just the it's all the documents. Okay. It's emails between the company and the DEQ and back and forth, and emails from the public and back and forth. We used to have a lot more transparency than we have in the last several years. And this is part of the problem. You know, when the county gets a report from their staff and their staff doesn't have all the information, you get a bad report that goes to the county. The one that Mitch mentioned says that, you know, these four other EPA sites are using natural attenuation. That is just not true. They are now, and after reviewing it, they do a review every few years, they are now looking into active remediation. Remember, those were sites that were not first a dioxane site. They were like other contaminant, TCE or TCA. And then later they found dioxane, and they wanted to see if natural attenuation worked, and now they're saying, no, it doesn't work, and it's not an acceptable thing, so now they're going to have active remediation.
Mitch, so, you want to respond to that?
Well, looking into active remediation and doing active remediation are two different things. In terms of the transparency, I'm confident, and I think the staff report that the county put out documents the level of transparency that DEQ has relative to some of the other Superfund sites. We share a lot of information that's not on the website directly with CARD members, and we'll continue to do so. We are involved in undertaking a public engagement strategy. That's part of the how we're going to spend some of the money that Roger mentioned that we're going to seek that we've sought an appropriation for. So we want to improve our public engagement. Even though we've been meeting with city, county, township, both Ann Arbor and Scioto Township staff regularly, we're not at all satisfied with the level or with the degree of engagement. And we're hoping that by taking a more concerted effort, we can come to a common understanding with more people and focus on assuring that people have accurate, reliable information on what the extent of contamination is, what the risks that are posed, and what's being done about this going forward. And another thing, Roger and I don't agree on everything, but we agree on a number of things. And I think one of the things we agree on is, unfortunately, this groundwater contamination is going to be around in this community for tens, likely hundreds of years. Even if you were to flip a switch today and the court were to order massive pumping and treating of contaminated groundwater on a scale that's not been done at any Superfund site that I'm aware of, it would still, given the physics of this stuff, take many, many, many years to reduce it to some level that's acceptable. So one thing Roger and I agree on, it's going to be around a long time, so we want to be engaged with the community to make sure you all have the best information available and not get unnecessarily scared, be able to bring your concerns forward, and that we can address concerns, this vapor intrusion, evaporating stuff from the contaminated groundwater. That's a new pathway that new information about potential. You know, this stuff is really hard to take out of the groundwater. That's why we oxidize it as opposed to do something like air stripping like we do other volatiles.
I've got two observations. First of all, you know, if you're trying to make sure the community understands, put more of these documents on the website. People know how to find your website. You know, let us know what's going on there. And number two, if you want community engagement, public engagement, you want people to come, offer them some beer. Works for us.
I'll drink to that.
I'll just add to that on the point of information. We are slowly but surely getting more information trickling in. You know, the DEQ has been responsive to recent concerns about things like, you know, on the edge of the plume out in Scio is the Rose Drive area just west of M14. Is the plume reach there? They just did some recent sampling that showed no detectable levels, so that was good to know. You know, they continue to test on Elizabeth Road, where, you know, every once in a while here and there we get a one part per billion or two part per billion hit of dioxin in residential wells. Those people are living with that and, you know, not knowing until the next time their water is tested if that's spiking or not. And, you know, there's some anxiety over there, but they are testing it and we are getting information. Right now, the DEQ, I shadowed them about a week or so ago. They're doing testing in the West Park area. They did some shallow, they dug a hole and took some samples there as an initial step to see what that says. And that's in the lab right now, I think. We'll get that back in the next week probably. And they're going to go out and put in shallow groundwater wells this month along 7th Street next to West Park.
So. Yeah, I think it's likely going to turn into July because we've got to work on getting our plans together and getting some access finalized.
Okay, but guys. The point is we're getting information.
That's right.
Okay, so here's the deal. I'm told that we've got a whole bunch of people with a lot of questions, and we've got about 20 minutes left. So this is the lightning round. You guys get 30 seconds each, and we're going to move to the next question, all right? Where are you, Kristen? Where's your next?
Way back there.
Oh, there you go.
Okay, my question can be answered with three words. How did it first get in the groundwater so deep? Did it drift or was it injected, number one? And number two, once this 5-square-mile sizable contamination drifts to the Huron River, isn't that going to wick it even faster through the water flow? And number two, with Ryan, yes or no?
This is number three question.
Part. One word, yes or no. Will you be a clearinghouse for information so people can get together and support the people they feel are looking out for them?
Well, I don't mean to answer for Ryan, but he does have editors. He doesn't get to make all the decisions. But go ahead.
Can you clarify your last question?
Oh, we lost the mic. Basically, she was asking, can you be a clearinghouse for all this information? Can you put it out regularly?
We've been very aggressive in reporting everything that we learn. We're trying to keep the community really informed. I made it a personal commitment at the beginning of this year to elevate our coverage of this issue. And I think, thank you, Vince. I think we've covered this from several angles, and there are several angles we haven't covered it from that I hope to continue doing that. And what was her first part of the question?
Well, she was asking these guys about, and I want to get to you, wicking once it hits the Huron, and they're the ones, was this stuff injected? You know, how to get
real quickly, because I only have 30 seconds, and I'm probably almost over that.
You are. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just recently reading the old reports, and, I mean, there were concerns about how they were disposing of their waste for all through the 60s, 70s, and 80s. It caused obnoxious odors. The neighborhood was just up in arms about it for decades. It smelled like feces. It was sewage smelling. They learned in 1981 that there was dioxin in their lagoon unlined at 25,000 parts per billion. There were concerns about that for 3 years. Dan Bicknell blew it open by discovering it in Third Sister Lake and showed that it was expanding. And so, yeah, it was injected. It was in lagoons. It was sprayed on the lawn. It was everything.
You got any follow-up to that? I mean,
Don't have 30 seconds. Let's go to the next question.
But next question.
But I'll tell you one thing. I'm going to be at the Green Fair next Friday. SRSW will have a booth there, and Vince will be there from the card. And we'll try to answer as many questions as we can.
Where is the Green Fair?
Green Fair is a block over at Main Street, Friday night. What is that, June 10th?
Yes.
June 10th, 6 o'clock to 9 o'clock. We'll have a booth there and some of the same displays and some of the same people.
Where's Kristen? There she is. Okay.
Hello, I'm a Purdue engineering graduate. I've seen some of the research into...
Name, please.
Name?
Yeah.
Mike.
Okay.
Pleasure to meet you.
All right.
Thanks for coming, guys. Anyhow, Purdue Engineering, Ann Arbor's my new home. I love it here. I've seen the results of UV research. I know it works, but my question is two parts. Number one, as I understood it, getting my engineering degree, there is no limited liability clause, and that if you pollute the environment and the legislation goes through for the 7.2, that Gelman is entirely on the line to... make amends to the environment. Part two, or, you know, is this true? Am I mistaken? And then part two, Well, let me come back to part
We've
two.
Got a 30-second limit on questions.
Yeah, that, we should have a 30-second limit on questions, too. Right?
Go ahead. Roger, Mitch, either one.
I'll defer to Mitch on this because when you get to the legal part, then you get the AG involved. And as you know, the AG right now is more worried about other things.
Another liability change that was made in 1995 from what the original Polluter Pay Act had is we've got a causation liability standard in Michigan. And so if you're responsible for the activity that caused the pollution, you've got the obligation to remediate it. Yet there's another clause, Section 2A of Part 201, if anybody wants to look it up, talks about a legally enforceable agreement that's in effect at the time the...
30 seconds, Mitch.
That the cleanup criteria that are embodied in the legally enforceable agreement are what control. So... Even we would have to go to court and get a court order to order remediation to the lower number.
Ryan?
And our state law is lax in the sense that it doesn't require actual cleanup. It only requires managing the risk of exposure. So a company, as long as they're managing the risk of exposure, doesn't have to actually fully clean up the pollution in the ground. It can fester there.
Next question.
Hi, my name's Anna, and I was kind of curious about, we've talked about sort of managing the dioxin from the groundwater, but what about like from the tap or from the well? Is there any way to treat that water as it's coming out of the tap or out of your well?
Not really. Not unless you got a lot of money, no.
I would agree with that. It's... Oxidizing is the best way to do it. Oxidation, it's not like some of the other organics where you can use a carbon filter. Reverse osmosis may have some effect, but you'd have to change the filter membranes quite a bit. So the best thing is to keep it out of the well.
I've been reading some of the city reports where they're talking hypothetically about, you know, years into the future they might have to treat the city water, source water for dioxin, and the phrase I saw was that it would be a significant cost.
Next question.
Over here.
I don't see you.
Hi, my name is Eric Boyd. First, I want to thank Roger and his organization for all their hard work over the years.
Thank you.
Second, my question. So I'm modestly well-informed, meaning I read the paper, et cetera, and I knew that buying a house in Scioto Township would have risks maybe around the wells, and I knew that eventually there might be a risk to our drinking water. I was pretty shocked that, you know, there might be a risk of swimming in the water at West Park. That wasn't something that occurred to me. So I don't really care if you can prove it or not, but my question would be is if you were much more informed than I were, are there any other places like West Park that all of a sudden there could theoretically be a risk? I don't care if you can prove it, but you wouldn't let your kid swim in that pond.
Well, I think the Third Sister Lake still has dioxin in it. First and Second Sister Lakes, I think, are dioxin at non-detect now.
Let me ask you, Mitch, what's the exposure level for body exposure, for showering in it, things like that? What's the dermatological level?
I don't know.
I think Robert Wagner said it was 754 parts per billion or something like that.
Under the current rules, I don't think we've got a number. I don't know what the proposed one was. Do you know, Roger?
Well, Gelman Science, maybe it was Paul at the time, tried to see if the EPA would weigh in on that, and the EPA response came back, well, it's basically the same as drinking it. And at the time, 85, I think it was 100 parts per billion of surface exposure. But that maybe should go down since the drinking water guidelines are down to single digits.
Have you run across that, Ryan, in your research?
I know a number of years ago, I believe I saw the number for body contact was 100 parts per billion. I don't know what it is today.
We had a draft number called a groundwater household use number of 350 parts per billion, but that's not an enforceable number. So I need to better understand what's in our proposed rules.
Okay, so we've got that question answered. Next question.
Over here.
Yes.
We're over here.
Hi, I'm Rita. My question is, we know that there is a source of the contamination, and it must be the most concentrated. Why isn't the cleanup starting at the point of concentration as opposed to farther out?
That's a great question. There has been and continues to be some pumping at what would be called the core area. And given the fact that this is so soluble and miscible, it's migrated very far. And after the court in 2004 against the DEQ's decision ordered the imposition of an institutional control and some of the other developments, given the complex geology, there's no longer a required pumping rate at various parts. They just have to meet a non-expansion objective on the west side of Wagner Road, as well as the other 2,800 part per billion objective east of Wagner.
So let me see if I can get this in layman's language. There was a concentration, but for decades now it's been...
There was. It's important.
Moving across.
That's why this is a great case study in the evolution. Roger, you need to turn it so he can see it. Great case study in the evolution of our program. This site, after the 1992 consent judgment, the company was required to restore the aquifer to unrestricted use using a risk-based number of 3. That number changed to 85. In 2004, the judge says that no longer applies for a certain part of the site. As we went on trying to... DEQ was left trying to enforce a bifurcated or a dualistic objective where in certain parts of the complicated geology site, we had to assure that they were going to restore the aquifer to unrestricted use, and in other parts, they were allowed to let it migrate. It got to be... We could have spent a lot of time fighting in court.
That's the most convoluted reasoning in the world.
That's the world in which we live. I wish it was less convoluted. Excuse me.
The court stuff that he mentioned there was that it was Judge Donald Shelton who drew this line around Ann Arbor and basically said this is a groundwater use prohibition zone. The plume can spread through it through the city and hit the Huron River at up to 2,800 parts per billion. That does not change with the DEQ's revised standards.
Okay, next question.
All right, we're over here this way.
We're over here. Wave.
To your left.
Oh, there you are.
Hey.
This question is for Roger Rail.
Name, please.
My name is Will Leaf.
Okay.
If you were on Ann Arbor City Council right now, what actions would you take on the dioxane issue?
The same action that Ann Arbor Township took.
Which is?
To go for the EPA resolution.
All right, next question. We have to wrap up here, you're saying? Five minutes. Let's make it fast. Let's go.
Hi, I'm Rita Locke Caruso, and my question is, if there is 1,4 dioxane detected in seeps or within 10 feet of the surface of the soil level, before the groundwater hits the Huron River, does that make the prohibition zone illegal, null and void? Because that prohibition zone is based on a 2,800 part per billion surface water to groundwater interface. And if there is contamination of 1,4 dioxane within 10 feet of the surface, then that's not the surface groundwater surface water interface.
That's an excellent question, Dr. Caruso. The answer is we need to wait and see. Because you're right, the 2,800 part per billion prohibition zone is based on groundwater discharge to surface water. We now have a proposed screening level for groundwater in contact with foundations. That is a screening level, and we'll need to evaluate whether, in fact, that number becomes a driver for a different form of a remedy. So I don't have a good answer for you other than the fact that there's a potential it could change, whether it's illegal or not remains to be seen.
Roger, what do you think of that answer that Mitch just gave?
Well, the wait and see is, we're way past the wait and see period. This is a map of the contamination as of 2015. The dark circles are the wells that have had their highest ever readings in the last 2 or 3 years. So which way is the plume going? Pretty much anywhere, right? Including down.
Ryan, any input? Next question. There you are. Hi, Kristen. You're fast.
Hi there. I'm Eric. Oh, that was loud. Just quick question. You know, we've discussed liability and all of that here tonight. Is there an actual timeline and an action plan in place to address the issue? I mean, that's something that hasn't been really made clear, in my opinion. even like a bulleted list, how is the problem actually going to be fixed? Because we've done a great job of discussing liability and who's to blame and all that and potential long-run mediation, but is there an actual set of actions that are planned by Gelman and by the DEQ to be undertaken to fix it?
Okay, I think they did answer that earlier. Can I just twist your question a little bit?
Sure.
Okay. If this stuff gets into the drinking water supply, where does Ann Arbor get its drinking water?
You mean if concentrations of dioxane get into
Barton
Pond?
I mean, that's the concern. If it gets into Barton Pond, if it gets into Ann Arbor's drinking water supply, where we get our water to drink, what are the alternatives then? Is there stripping, as Ryan suggested? Is there
quick answer?
Do we go to Detroit for water?
Detroit or Flint?
Yeah,
potentially it could get it from groundwater wells. Yet I think that's we are monitoring and working with the company to monitor to ensure that doesn't happen. The modeling that you saw reported that Ryan reported on a couple weeks ago from Dr. Lemke at Wayne State. The good news, I was surprised that the headline wasn't, the good news is none of the particles make it to Barton Pond. Instead, the issue was the water, you know, the dioxane is going to get to the, is likely already at Huron River. Good news is none of the particles get there. We're going to monitor to ensure that that's the case and then have a plan in place to intercept it before it were to get to Barton Pond.
That modeling was based on particles released on Wagner Road, not west or north of Wagner.
That's true. And Dr. Lemke also said that particles released further west, they did some simulations and didn't see an effect up to the north. And that's consistent with what the city's consultant showed in their modeling.
You guys have had your 30 seconds. Brian, please.
So I'll try to sum it up quickly. The city has been studying this. It's thinking right now about rebuilding a large portion of its water treatment plant on Sunset Road, unrelated to dioxane. That's going to be tens of millions of dollars, just a project totally unrelated to this issue. And as part of that, a couple years ago, they did an alternatives analysis that looked at where else could we get water if we're not actually still taking it from Barton and running it through this plant. And we actually, so 15% of our water comes from groundwater wells out by the airport. There's talks of expanding that. That's actually in the city's capital improvements plan. So that's going forward. That's not a replacement or contingency plan for Barton, though. Detroit Water, as Roger said, is. The estimate I've seen for that is that would cost us $200 to $300 million to do that. So that's an expensive proposition. Beyond that, there's, like I said, treating the water for dioxane at the plant, and that would be a significant cost.
Okay, one more question. I tell you, I'm going to give one more question after this. So if jump up and down, shout whatever you need to after he finishes his question, then we have the answer for the last question.
Bernie Lugar. You all have bosses. You all do the job you have to do. Whom do we vote for who really looks for the issue and keeps the politics out of it? Who are persons who really are for the issue we can vote for as a citizen?
Well, government's making decisions in this. You're never going to keep politics out of it altogether. The courts are making decisions in this. They're politically appointed. Go ahead if you guys think you can answer that question.
My short answer on that is government is infrastructure.
Okay.
If you cut government too much, there goes your infrastructure. We've already seen that happen in Flint. We don't want to see that happen here.
Time
to drop the mic.
And my best answer to that is participate in the process, ask your candidates where they stand on the issues, be an informed voter.
Okay, I've just been informed that I'm not allowed to take another question. It's Steve's fault, so blame him. I wanted you all to get a chance, but Steve won't let me. Thank you very much. I want to thank our guest. Ryan Stanton is with Ann Arbor News, MAM Live. Mike Edelman is with the MDEQ, and Roger Rail with the Sile Residents for Safe Water. Thanks very much. Thanks for coming. I know sometimes it's tough to do these. You guys did a great job.